When I first started researching Cop Shock, what surprised me the most was that time and time again, I came across studies that said that the biggest stressor was the department itself. In Cop Shock, I described a situation with Jonathan Figueroa, who was a canine officer, and he was there on 9/11. And he ended up working on the pile, looking for pieces of bodies for 98 days. In Cop Shock, I talk about how this one dispatcher was talking to this woman, and her husband shot her and killed her on the phone. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. Along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond, I'm David Dashinger. On this episode, we'll be speaking with trauma expert and author of the book Cop Shock, Alan Cates, about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and how to survive it by employing resiliency techniques. Make sure to catch all our episodes by liking and subscribing on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc. We're on bbsradio.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, all the podcast platforms, and go to our website for guest info and all the past episodes. It's respondertv.com. We'll be right back to speak with Alan after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers with vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW, EMTB. Well, tonight, or today as the case may be, we're going to be speaking with Alan Cates, who's a trauma expert and author of the book Cop Shock, Surviving Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, PTSD. Alan's book is praised as the definitive survival guide for police PTSD sufferers, and A&E Television produced a program based on Cop Shock's findings. 3 weeks after 9/11 happened, Alan delivered a seminar to Port Authority peer support officers about preventing and managing PTSD symptoms. And Alan's also given seminars about PTSD, suicidal thinking, post-shooting trauma, psychological and emotional survival after a critical incident, and resiliency techniques for many organizations. We're very happy to welcome you, Alan, to Respond to Resilience.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Also wanted to say, having read your book recently, that it's not like a dry textbook. Actually, the first half of it is filled with about a dozen, say they're gripping stories of real life incidents that affected the careers of law enforcement, firefighter, and other professionals, even a dispatcher. And it shows in depth how one's life can spiral somewhere where you never thought it could go due to a traumatic incident encountered on the job. So it's a great book, and I encourage anyone in responder professions to check it out. And with that, I'll let Stacey go ahead and start the questions.
So, Alan, can you give us some examples of firefighters and police officers with PTSD and tell us like a couple of intriguing stories from
your book? I'd like to start with one of the stories in Cop Shock about 9/11 and Jimmy Brown, who started his career as a police officer and decided it wasn't for him, and he became a firefighter. And he was stationed right across the street from the World Trade Center. And so, of course, he was there, and he went into the North Tower. I tell his story in the book, which is harrowing, and it's amazing that anybody could survive that. And what's most important about the story, apart from how he managed to survive, because he was buried in concrete, was how he avoided PTSD. And he did it because when he was a police officer, he volunteered for a group called PAPA, which is Police Officers Providing Peer Assistance. Mm-hmm. And after he recovered from being literally buried alive, he knew that he couldn't go back to work. Hmm. And so he went to see them and asked what he should do, because he's experiencing all these horrific feelings, nightmares, flashbacks. He was shaking all the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he had a lot of classic signs of what would be PTSD, but he wasn't diagnosed with it yet because it takes 30 days before you can be diagnosed with it.
Right.
So he was, in fact, diagnosed with acute stress disorder, which mm-hmm. is the lead up to PTSD and has very similar symptoms. Mm-hmm. But by going to see this group, he was assigned a peer support person who, and apart from the fact that he was now a firefighter, it didn't matter because the symptoms were the same. And this peer support person helped him work through all his symptoms and to bring out his natural resiliency and to learn new resiliency techniques about how to deal with everything.
Right.
So that prevented him from getting PTSD, whereas in my book, of course, I recount the stories of many who did develop post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I interviewed over 200 people, police officers and, firefighters, dispatchers, who had developed PTSD. And from those, I selected about 13 stories that I felt represented a good cross-section of the kinds of symptoms that people would experience. In terms of resiliency, I think one of the biggest things that especially Jimmy Brown, who was in this chapter, learned was to be positive. Now, how can you possibly be positive after you just experienced something like PTSD, after so many firefighters were killed and police officers?
Right.
And but it's not laughing at anything. It's just realizing that you will go on, that life will change, that this is not going to define you. And I think that is one of the most important things, is that to decide, actually actively make the decision, this mm-hmm. is not going to define me. I will go on, and I'll get through this. And mm-hmm. and you can. The good news is, when you're looking at PTSD, about a third of like police officers, firefighters, and so on, they may develop symptoms of PTSD. That doesn't mean that they have it.
Correct.
But they may develop symptoms. Yeah. And if they practice this resiliency and bring out their natural ability to adjust to terrible situations, as well as learn some techniques, they mostly can get through it.
Hmm. Well, you touched on support groups as being part of the process for Jimmy Brown. How do support groups help responders to process feelings and bring an understanding to their normal reaction to abnormal circumstances?
What's so great about PAPA is that is a peer support group, meaning they're not trying to give you therapy. They're trying to get you back on the job. They're trying to make you see things differently. They're changing your perspective, uh-huh. which is the most important thing when you're dealing with trauma. Change your perspective. Back up for a second. And that's why often I will recommend to police officers who call me, I said, have you ever tried journaling? Write down your feelings and then read them. Because when you write down your feelings, suddenly it's like, oh, gee, I don't really feel that strongly about this part of it. And it reduces that tremendous impact of how awful you feel. And so that's one thing that I suggest. But going to a support group, especially a peer support group, knowing that they're not there to play therapist, they're
right.
there to help you. They might mm-hmm. recommend that you see a therapist after all of this if you're still having trouble, weeks later. But at least initially, they can help bring out the resiliency that you are born with, as well as teach you things that you can do to try to get through the situation that you're in. For one thing, mm-hmm. they will also look at, okay, what happened the last time you were involved in something very serious? What did you do? How did you get through that? Mm-hmm. So it's really important to look at your past experiences and how you survived and say, yeah, I did get through that. So mm-hmm. why couldn't I get through this?
Right.
And there are a lot of other things, too, is look at people who you think are models of resiliency, people who, say who also experience 9/11, and they seem to be doing okay. And why are they doing okay?
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
One of the things that I tell police officers in particular, and I'm sure this applies to firefighters, is that, and it's going to sound so simple, is talk about it. And especially cops, they don't talk about it. They are trained not to.
Yeah.
And so, sure, you hear about choir practice. They go into the bar and they have a few drinks, and they're mm-hmm. telling war stories and all that. But they're not really talking about it. They're not talking about those feelings inside mm-hmm. that are gathering and growing.
Right. It's a vulnerability that they have to access. And I think that, you know, the macho stereotype for any first responder kind of prevents them from doing that, right? If they're supposed to be strong and tough and to tap into that vulnerability and to say, I was really scared when the building started coming down or whatever. That's hard.
Yeah, you've had exactly on the big issue, especially for men.
Oh.
Is that they don't want to show how vulnerable they are.
Mm-mm.
And I've talked to some cops about it, for example, and they said, well, what it comes down to is, you know, if you're working with your partner and your partner is spilling his guts to you or her, you know, guts to you, and it's like, you have to ask yourself, wait a minute, are they going to be good in a bad situation if I get stuck and I need backup? Or are they going to be feeling their emotions?
Right.
And of course, what I just said is totally false, but you can't say that that's wrong. That's how people feel. You know, will this person back me up?
The other thing about support groups is this concept of universality. It's like, I'm not the only one who has those feelings, you know? I think sometimes critical incident stress debriefing has that universality effect, too. It's not group therapy. It's not necessarily even a peer support group, but it's sort of like, oh, Joe was also really upset after that call, you know, and it kind of gives you permission if one of your own admits they were scared or angry or went home and couldn't sleep or went home and cried, whatever the case may be. So it makes it okay. And I think when first responders see that they're not the only one that had this, it's no longer just this private reaction that now they're labeling as abnormal. It's actually a very normal reaction that they're having to an unusual circumstance.
That's exactly right. And I've had several phone calls with police officers who read Cop Shock, and the first thing they say is, now I know I'm normal.
Oh,
because the book shares experiences of others who have experienced the same thing that they're experiencing. And they have a view that to engage in violence, to view violence as even as a witness, that's normal. And the book shows them that, no, it's not normal. You're still a human being no matter what your training is, no mm-hmm. matter how good it is.
Right.
You're still a human being and you're going to react like a human being. And you have to accept that and realize, yes, you are normal. So that's a really big thing for first responders, is to know that they are normal and they're responding normally.
So I'd love to go a little deeper into this concept of, you know, how some people are affected differently or cope differently with traumatic incidents, and whether that's something having to do with how we're wired, or is it proactive work that we can do to prepare for those kind of traumatic incidents, or is it our perception? Do I perceive a call differently than my captain does, and that's why it doesn't bother him, but it bothers me? What do you think causes that?
Actually, I think you just stated exactly what the issue is. You can get two police officers, for example. They come upon the same horrific scene, and one of them will react very negatively and have a lot of emotions, where the other one will not. And it has to do a lot with their past experiences, how they dealt with those experiences, whether they talk or not, whether they are already in a support group, or whether they have one person. Because that's all it really takes, is one person who they trust, who they can sit down with, and that person will be honest with them and tell them what they think. You're not asking that person to fix you. You're just asking that person to listen.
Right.
And by getting all that out, when you have that kind of support, it goes a long way to preventing PTSD, to preventing a trauma from getting out of control.
All right, and a trauma or a sorrow shared, there's this quote, and it's, I don't know who it's attributed to. I think the one I have in my office, it just says unknown. A sorrow shared is halved, right? A joy shared is doubled, right? So as you say, if you have just that one person that you can share your burden with, you're not burdening them. You're actually just letting them in on what you're going through, and now you're not caring as much.
Yeah. So. There's also a concept that's been floating around for several years, and the first time I really encountered it was when I was asked to speak to the National Guard. And I was asked to speak about post-traumatic growth. And that's a double-edged sword. So I read up on it, and it scared me a little bit. Because you can say, yes, you can grow from a traumatic situation. That is all very possible and likely. But at the same time, you have to be careful that you don't put yourself in a category where I have to grow. And if I'm showing signs that I'm not growing, there's something wrong with me. And as a matter of fact, I was asked when I was addressing the National Guard to talk about that. And a general had created a scale of 1 to 10 of where are you on this scale of post-traumatic growth? And it's like, think about it. I just scored a 4 or a 5, so I guess I'm going nuts. I mean, and so I did give the lecture, but it wasn't quite the lecture they were expecting because I spoke against it. And I told them how careful they have to be when talking about that kind of growth. So that, yes, they know that it is possible, but it's not something you should be focusing on right away and saying, oh, I better achieve and I better hit a 9 or a 10 on this scale.
Correct. Right. The growth is very private, too. It's personal, it's private, it's different for everybody. And so to have a scale that you apply to everyone doesn't really make sense to me.
I'll tell him you said that next time.
He now hates me, that general.
And also, when we're talking about resiliency, it's trying to find a purpose in life. And a lot of officers and firefighters I've talked to, it's not just, you know, yes, I go there and I try to save people and work with people in my job, but there's something outside of work that fulfills them. And, you know, maybe they volunteer. For example, let's just go back to Jimmy Brown for a second, a firefighter from 9/11. So first he recognized that he needed help. He needed help right away. And one thing that I quote him in the book as saying is that I got help right away. I didn't let it fester. I didn't wait for it. But I knew right away I needed help. And he got that help. And then what he did is he volunteered. Is once he became adjusted to what had happened to him, he volunteered on this hotline to help police officers and firefighters. And he found that very fulfilling. And also it changed his perspective of things. Of course, he was also relating to people who were there who experienced the same things he did, he knew he was not alone. Mm-hmm. He knew he was normal, that whatever he was feeling inside is what they're feeling inside, and right. he was able to help them. So volunteering is really important for your own resiliency. It's something that you can actively do and see if it does fulfill you.
It's part of post-traumatic growth, too, just to throw that in there, to give back, right? If you've been helped, what I find is I have a lot of clients that then go on and try to help others, you know, because now that they feel like, oh, well, you know, you can rise above this. I want to get the message out. So giving back and helping others is a sign of post-traumatic growth.
Also, during some of my talks to the National Guard, I talked to them about humor therapy or laughter therapy.
Yeah.
And at first it sounds like, oh, come on, that's ridiculous. But when I was researching, it's like, holy smokes, they use it in hospitals and treatment centers. And sure. it's very effective. Okay, so mm-hmm. what does this mean? So it's more than telling a joke. It's finding the humor in some things. But it's also just, you know, if you look in the mirror and you smile at yourself, you immediately start to feel good. Mm-hmm. And there are cases with people who have, like, they've had lesions on their arms and legs. They're in serious trouble. And they're shown very funny films.
Yes.
Mostly Charlie Chaplin. And they have found that the lesions start to heal.
Yeah.
Which is, it's pretty remarkable stuff. So one of the things I also read about humor therapy is that if you make yourself laugh, I know this sounds, what? How you just make yourself laugh? Yeah, make yourself have a belly laugh. Just start uh-huh. laughing. And your body does not know the difference between if you have a stimulus, if you've heard uh-huh. a joke, or if you're just making yourself laugh.
Yeah.
And I did that with the National Guard, by the way. I had everybody stand up in the aisles and do a belly laugh.
Oh,
and I have to say, it was pretty funny. But people enjoyed it, and they learned from that you can make yourself do things right. that make you feel good when you're feeling terrible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Good stuff. I'd love to talk more about PTSD and the onset of it and why some people will experience symptoms sooner and other people maybe later, possibly years after the trauma. And of course, that comes into the conversation about documenting this for purposes of insurance and workers' comp. Yeah. And if we're not aware of it early in the game, you know, how does this all affect handling or, you know, documentation of these traumas in terms of insurance and comp claims?
That's always a very difficult question, especially when you're dealing with workers' comp or the equivalent in other states. In Cop Shock, I described the situation with Jonathan Figueroa, who was a canine officer, and he was there on 9/11. And he ended up working on the pile looking for pieces of bodies for 98 days. It was extremely debilitating. He tried to get off it, but they didn't have enough personnel. So he continued to work on it. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, he had, his brother-in-law was missing, and it turns out that he was killed mm-hmm. On 9/11. And he was doing okay. He was doing okay for 5 years. And then suddenly, as he describes it in Cop Shock, he said he went to visit a police officer who'd been hit by a car. It wasn't too bad, you know, a broken arm or something. And he went to visit him in the hospital, and he said suddenly he had all these symptoms, mm-hmm. and he was shaking, he was stuttering, and he had all the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder from that point on, where he couldn't sleep at night. He was having nightmares and flashbacks, and he would try to avoid anywhere where he'd been, which reminded him of the trauma. And he was very agitated all the time. And so he started by seeing a peer support group and trying to work through this. But what was really important for him was because he tried to keep it under wraps, and he started drinking. And he actually took his gun from his locker as a police officer, and he had decided he was going to kill himself because he couldn't stand it anymore. Mm-hmm. But he decided that first he was going to speak to his sergeant. And luckily his sergeant was very sympathetic, immediately picked up the phone and called a peer support group and sent him over. And from there, Jonathan, you know, he saw a therapist. He worked through it all. And then he was able to help a lot of others. But that was 5 years later. And that, that question did come up. What about insurance? How do you prove something like this? And so he attributed it to working for 98 days straight on the pile, as well as other incidents in his life. When you look at all the in-between, it's like, okay, there aren't too many incidents. But all it takes is one incident or a combination of incidents. That's where workers' comp ends up having problems. Because they don't like to recognize a that you've had a bunch of incidents that may be considered low-level traumatic incidents. And you put them all together, and if you haven't dealt with them in any way, they accumulate, and they can cause PTSD.
That closet gets full.
Some people have been winning. They've had to sue workers' comp. Sounds terrible, but they've had to sue workers' comp. And it's something that I put on my website to make officers and firefighters understand that the first time that they apply for workers' comp, they will likely be denied. It's rare that they are accepted. And I explain that this is part of the game, because you're in a game now. And it sounds terrible. And you feel that you have made a big sacrifice and you've given your life to this. This is your calling. It's not just a job. But that's not how they see things. This is all about money. And when you think about it in that way, then now you're playing a game. And so you appeal, and you keep appealing to show why your appeal, while you, why your disability request is legitimate. So it's very hard when it's over a period of time, like 5 years.
Yeah, well, it makes sense.
You can do it. And police officers and firefighters, unfortunately, they've had to sue workers' comp, and they are winning more and more of their lawsuits based on PTSD claim.
I unloaded 32 years of emotion.
This job isn't a joke, and it can hurt you.
How does yoga or meditation help with that?
Coming to terms with who you are.
You know, nobody calls us because they're having a good day.
It's really the suicide that becomes a huge issue.
People are more trustworthy with the dog.
Sleep deprivation helps them either be better or worse.
Completely secretive when we started this.
So it's pretty much taboo.
Take care of the people next to you.
First responders really being open about what they're struggling with.
If we know that, let's raise awareness.
Brings you together to talk about it, and it tells you you're not alone.
So I have another question. You know, since exposure to trauma is inherent to first responder work, so what are your thoughts on preventing the development of PTSD?
Again, I think it starts with talking, but preparing yourself beforehand, knowing who you're going to talk to before something happens, and having a routine that you know you can engage in if you're traumatized. Once you're traumatized, you're not thinking straight. So you need something that's going to help you, like exercise, and have an exercise a program in place before something happens to you. Have people that you know that could help you, have them in place so you know that one day you can just call them out of the blue and say, okay, that day I told you about has arrived, and they will be there for you. If you have to invent all of this suddenly, after you've been traumatized, you're going to have a really hard time.
That's much more difficult. And so don't you think you're up against denial? Like, you know, if there's any mention of PTSD associated with being a first responder, oh, that's not going to be me. I'm not going to be that guy. Don't you think you're up against denial? And so therefore, it's always reactive, or for the most part, it's reactive.
Yeah, I agree with you. And all we can try to do is continue to have more and more courses in police departments, fire departments, and so on.
Like the academy.
So you understand that this is a normal reaction, and you can expect something to happen. And not deny it, but just reinforce that you are a human being, and you will respond no matter what.
I think it needs to be introduced in the fire academy, the police academy. You know, not doom and gloom, but sort of like, let's face it, you're going to be seeing, you're going to be witness to some pretty awful things that happen, you know, to humans. And so, you know, to be aware that this may affect you. And I'm not, you know, we're not guaranteeing this is going to affect you, or you're going to develop, you know, mental illness because of it, or symptoms because of it. But you do need to be aware, and you do need to have a plan in case you start having any of the following symptoms. And then they should instruct on, you know, depression, anxiety, PTSD.
You just hit on something which is really important, which is the whole concept of mental illness. And is PTSD mental illness? And it is not. It can develop into it. But I think that's one of the reasons why you get denial and police officers and firefighters saying, that's not going to be me.
Right.
And you get
nobody
that
wants
kind of
a disorder. Nobody, but it is an injury. It's you know, excessive chronic exposure of the brain to cortisol. Eventually, your brain is not going to work the way it's supposed to. So it's a brain injury. That's the way I like to talk about it. So we call it PTSI.
Yes, that's really what it should be called, post-traumatic stress injury.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of efforts to get the group that puts together the diagnostic and statistical manual to change how they designate PTSD and call it PTSD. But they say that they don't feel it really captures what has happened. I feel it does. Mm-hmm. I think it really addresses the issue, and it's something that that first responders can embrace and say, yes, it's an injury, and it's something that you should be able to present to workers' comp. I know they don't want you to change it to post-traumatic stress injury because they're afraid that they're going to get more and more requests for disability pensions, which is the wrong way of thinking.
It is. But like you said, it all comes down to money. So,
Well, Alan, in your book, Cop Shock, quite a few of the chapters, you tell the story, incredibly gripping stories about how one incident can spiral a person's career completely out of control and their life out of control. They're already feeling danger doing their job, but then they've gone through this traumatic incident, and now they're not feeling support or actually getting some kind of backlash from their supervisors. Can you talk about what that is about, the stress, and how one incident can really derail a career?
When I first started researching Cop Shock, what surprised me the most was that time and time again I came across studies that said that the biggest stressor was the department itself. And I thought, and I quote 8 different studies in Cop Shock that say exactly this, and why, and and it just seems there's so much pressure put on police officers and firefighters that by the department, that as one cop describes it, he says, "I can spot the bad guy on the street real good, but I can't spot the guy sticking the knife in my back," and that seems to be a common theme when you speak with police officers or firefighters, is that, you know, who's got my back and why are they treating me this way? Mm-hmm. Now, I have talked to, you know, lieutenants, sergeants, police chiefs about exactly this, and they have a totally different view of how they do their job because they have stresses from above them.
Of course.
And you know, stress finds its way down.
Yeah.
And but they don't explain to the rank and file why they are asking for certain things to be
right.
done.
Yeah.
And but the biggest question too is that why don't departments support their personnel more when something happens?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a, for example, a shooting or an assault of some kind, and the officer is considered to be at fault or not. I mean, right away, it always seems to be a police officer's fault, whether they say anything or not.
Right.
Until later, it's proven that they were well within the limits of what they were supposed to do, but that
right.
usually ends up on page 16 of the newspaper.
Right. Right. Yeah, you have body cam footage versus, someone's phone footage, right? And so what gets put on YouTube seems to be the aftermath or the reaction of the police officer, but not necessarily what the perpetrator is doing to instigate the response from the police officer. So it's skewed. And especially after, the George Floyd murder, the focus, the spotlight on police being the bad guy and excessive use of force, et cetera. So, I really think that cops have gotten a bad rap, because of these incidents that are highlighted and also video footage provided by civilians.
So. Yeah, and I think it's a good thing to have that footage, but at the same time, I think you're right that we see generally the aftermath. We don't see the lead up. We don't
right.
see how the cop, for example, has to rely on his training and try and control the situation because things are getting out of control.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see that in these videos.
No.
We just see the aftermath.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
that skews the public's image of what a police officer is.
When I was also first researching Cop Shock, what I ran into initially was that there are a number of peer support units that had been started up across the country. When it came to firefighters, they resisted it. The departments resisted it, and the firefighters kept telling me, "Oh no, we don't need this." And then I would talk to them about the experiences that they had, and I said, "Doesn't this sound like you need some kind of intervention or somebody to talk to about it?"
Mm-hmm.
And so they would agree, but they were a lot more reluctant than police officers to embrace the idea of peer support.
Huh, interesting. Maybe because they have the brotherhood and sitting around the dinner table and being able to talk about things, not necessarily at the level that it should be, but maybe there's the resistance came from that. Is that what you think?
It's like an informal peer support.
Correct.
Yeah.
So maybe they felt like, oh, no, we got this covered?
It's possible, but, police think that they also have that same kind of brotherhood when they're knocking back with you at the
bar. Police ride alone. They ride alone in the cruiser. They go to a call. It could be a horrific call. They get back in the cruiser. They go to the next call. Whereas the firefighters go back to the firehouse and, take care of the equipment and maybe have a meal together. And, there's that buffering effect of having people around you. Connection. I think it just all comes down to connection. And isolation is like the worst thing that somebody can deal with following trauma. That's the worst condition to exist under is isolation.
Yeah, that's good. I always suggest to cops who call me, I talk to them about, okay, well, who are you talking to? Who can you rely on? Well, I don't really have anybody. And then so I would delve into it with them as well. Let's talk about your family, your friends. And they just need one person who they can talk to and rely on.
Yep.
But you're right about firefighters. They are able to do that. Cops just go from job to job to job.
Right.
And things are often not resolved.
My dad started out as a patrol officer, and then later in his career became a dispatcher. The man never slept. He ended up with health issues, and he stepped away from police work after he had a heart attack at 51. So, you know, I'd like you to talk about the stress of dispatchers.
I was, at first, I didn't fully grasp how difficult it is for dispatchers. And when I talked to them, you know, they explained, well, you know, we're sort of like cops in a way, only worse. You know, we hear what's going on the phone, and then it's handed off, and we don't get any resolution. And they hear some pretty horrific, traumatic things. Mm-hmm. Like in Cop Shock, I talk about how this one dispatcher was talking to this woman, and her husband shot her and killed her on the phone. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
And they had no resources. They didn't have peer support. So they would try to talk to each other, but they were all kind of suffering.
Yeah.
And so finally they were getting some support and diagnosis that they were getting post-traumatic stress disorder. And they needed the same kind of care that police officers were getting. And they weren't getting it. They also told me about how everybody brings in donuts to the dispatchers.
Yeah.
And they said, on average, each dispatcher gains about 15 pounds per year.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's pretty unhealthy. And even and when they go home, they take everything home with them in their minds.
Sure.
Because
right.
nothing is resolved.
Well, it's a sedentary job.
Yeah. It's a sedentary job.
And they just, you know, it's... A lot of the calls are just irritating, and some of the calls are not even necessary, but then there are those harrowing calls, and they're getting it firsthand. They're getting, you know, the screaming person, you know, who's panicked, and all of that affects the dispatcher who's listening to it. It all goes in.
Right, it's just the one sense. They're just hearing. They're not. It's not like a full sensory experience, so it's just something that they're listening to, processing on that level. And in, as a job, they don't tend to move much, right? They're confined to a space. It's really hard to take breaks. If they need to decompress or diffuse after a difficult call, they may not never have the chance in a shift to actually, you know, step out and whatever they
go
have to do.
Go for a walk.
Yeah. And also the fact that what they're hearing is all audio.
Right.
And has been shown with when you compare, say, radio to television, that with radio, people tend to use their imagination a lot.
Hmm.
So imagine a dispatcher, they hear all this stuff, and then they imagine what is going on and what happened afterwards.
Right.
So it it can have quite an impact on them.
Yeah. I mean, as a fire officer, quite often I would come back after a call, and our dispatchers were in-house, and they really appreciated hearing our description of what the scene was like, what we encountered, how we took care of the problem, because not only are they just hearing it, but they don't get any involvement once they end the call. We show up on scene and they're off the radio, so to speak.
Yeah.
So it was really helpful, I think, for them to have a complete picture or a resolution of what actually took place when they initiated the call.
Yeah. Dispatchers I've talked to, they said that some cops had started to do that, that they would call them afterwards and let them know so they had some kind of resolution to a particularly harrowing call.
Yes.
I think another thing that we can touch on with you, Alan, if you could talk to us about it, is family and friends. If a family or loved one becomes aware that their responder has become traumatized or is suffering from some effects of PTSD, what can they do?
I know they need to see someone. And I have an example in Cop Shock of a police officer who was involved in a shootout. He went to the hospital to be checked out. In the meantime, his wife is called, and all they say to her is that your husband's been involved in a shooting. and then they hang. Yeah. And she's at work. She's hysterical. She doesn't know what to know. Is he dying? I mean, what has happened to him?
Yeah.
So they send an officer to get her and to bring her to the hospital. And she said that he drove as if her husband was going to be dead in 5 minutes. Mm. And she said by the time she got there, she was so upset that, he was fine. They had checked him out. They thought that he might have been shot, but he wasn't. It's what happened after this, where all the attention was on her husband, and there was no attention on her and what she was going through. And she said that she finally realized that the life that she enjoyed with her husband and her family could be over at any moment. And she was not sleeping. She stopped eating. She was experiencing a lot of symptoms of first acute stress disorder and then into PTSD. Right. So finally, she went to see a counselor, a therapist, who worked with her and worked through her PTSD. So the effect on the family can be pretty extraordinary. And this happens with children as well, that if they see their father or mother experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms as a result of their occupation, they can start developing very similar symptoms. They almost mock the same symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Alan, any other points that you wanted to speak about that we didn't cover?
I think we've covered a lot. Cop Shock itself covers an extraordinary amount. I spent 6 years on research, and people have asked me, why did it take you so long? I said, well, first of all, I'm not a psychologist. I'm a journalist.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of contact and experience with police officers. And so I got to know them before I got involved in writing Cop Shock. But at the same time, what I discovered is that, I thought that I would have the book finished in 6 months. So it took me 6 years. A slight underestimation. And it's because all the issues I got into, I would read a dozen studies. Uh-huh. And a few of them would be the opposite of what the other ones are.
Oh, yeah.
So I had to figure out which ones are really true. So, of course, I had to read more studies. I had to talk to therapists. And so it was a very long process to really get a feel for what was happening. And whether it was divorce or not sleeping at night. There was a great deal involved in every single issue in the book.
Well, what an amazing service you've done, though, for the responder community by writing this book. And I am curious, where is it being used out there in the world?
I'm sorry, where is the what?
How is it being used out there in the world in terms of, is it used in training? Is it used in different organizations recommended?
It's been used in police academies and in various organizations, in departments itself. As a matter of fact, the Phoenix Police Department last year ordered hundreds of copies for their officers. And so they are using them in departments as well as police associations, police unions. They have been distributing them to their members, which I'm gratified about because everyone needs to get it. And to get a sense of what they have experienced and what they can do about their symptoms, as well as retired police officers have read Cop Shock and gotten a lot out of it.
Right. And it's not just the stories. You also have amazing set of resources in there, which are going to be very helpful for people. Yes. And tell us where we can find you out there on the Internet or social media.
You can find the book at www.copshock.com, one word, copshock.com, and there's a great deal of information on the website about PTSD, about first responders, and other articles concerning that.
Fantastic. Well, Alan, thank you so much for being with us today and for sharing your book. I am absolutely sure it's going to change some more lives than it probably has already, but we really value your being with us and talking about these really important topics.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a very thorough book, and you know, I can understand why it took 6 years to write, because it's a good piece of writing. It's chock full of information, and I think anybody who picks it up will get something out of it.
Yeah, and what surprised me also was that I assumed that the military would be like the second audience. The first audience would be, you know, police and firefighters and that. Mm-hmm. But actually, the second artist turned out to be therapists. The second audience turned out to be therapists.
Interesting.
Because not all therapists are trained in this sort of thing.
Right. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Check out our website, respondertv.com. You can find us on YouTube, Responder Resilience, Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., and all the podcast platforms, Apple, and Spotify, and PBSRadio.com. Until the next episode, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.